I'm Walt Wedeen, and the discussion we're going to have today is entitled Thought for Food Stewardship in Agriculture. Earlier this week, we've been talking about sort of the history of agriculture, where it originated, and about the time, which was around when they moved from hunting and gathering to formal agriculture, about 8,000 or 10,000 BC, before the Common Era. And that coincided quite closely with the beginning of the domestication of plants and animals. One of the earliest domestications on record was wheat. We talked the other day quite a bit about wheat and how it's moved from the Middle East, where it was domesticated, on throughout the whole world to become one of our most important food plants, or most important crops today, which provides food directly for humans. Another one we talked about was rice, and this supports more people in their food requests than any other crop in the world. But it's not quite as extensively grown as wheat. Of course, the other ones of the grains that are very, very important would be maize or corn, which originated in the Americas. It's believed it started or was domesticated in Mexico and then taken to South America, and then through various means ended up in what became the United States. At the time of Columbus, they found the Native Americans, or Native Central Americans, growing corn in Cuba, the country which became Cuba. So the grains are of tremendous importance. Then the other main class of food plants that are very, very important are the legumes. The legumes are maybe best typified in our mind by beans, peas, vetches, and one of the oldest ones is lucerne or alfalfa. They originated in the Middle East, or domesticated in the Middle East. The Romans used alfalfa, or they called it lucerne, very extensively in crop rotations. And that system was passed on into Western Europe and used in America. And certainly the ones that practice crop rotation diligently would qualify for being good stewards of in agriculture. Well, moving on, and of course animals have been very, very important. Way back before the time of their domestication, they were important to the hunters and gatherers. And they're very important today for many reasons, not only for meat, milk, and wool, but for moving freight around and cartage of various types in lesser developed countries. And as we discussed one of the other days, in rice culture, water buffalo are still used. I was in the months of April in Poland, and horses are still used in the fields in Poland in some cases. And so for attraction or for power, animals are very important. And then they're for many other reasons too, hides and all these other factors. Now, if you take a look at this broad sweep over time, and it might be good to point out, since we have a little different group every day, that if you take the period of time when hunters and gatherers were on this earth, and say it extends here, and they've been able to go back and piece together information that would indicate that these people got along pretty well. They had rites and ceremonies and so forth. And then you come in with the domestication of the crops and plants, or the plants that we have now as crops, and the animals that we use, that this is just sort of a little blip in time from 8,000 BC up to the present time, compared to what was going on before. So some have raised the question, well, goodness, why was this agriculture ever developed? I mean, maybe this was one of the biggest mistakes in of all time, that agriculture was developed, because now then we have, in this shorter period of time, many problems arising, many people questioning, is agriculture going the way we want it to go? What are those problems? So I just raise that, that this is what's said by some. Well, certainly, if you think from the standpoint of stewardship of land, it might be good to just think about the word stewardship. If you look it up, which I did just this morning in the big dictionary, steward has about five or six meanings, but they're all relate to that you're taking care of somebody else's property. If you're a steward on a ship, or you're... So stewardship is basically the thought what we take care of, if we're stewards, is not ours, basically. And in the context of agriculture, you can see then that it would say, well, this land, this is not really ours. We maybe have deed and title to this, and we got it from our parents or whatever, but it really isn't ours. So the Native Americans had a different idea of who owned the land, maybe than we do. Okay? Now, there's another term that's very closely related to that, is the term husbandry, which comes from the word house bondry. And I have not seen anybody saying that the word husbandry is bad. In other words, it maybe should be wifery, you should have wifery because you have husbandry. But husbandry is a term that's been used a lot. The first course I took in agricultural college was, one of the first courses was Animal Husbandry 1, which meant it was about the care and the management and so forth of animals. Crop husbandry. So stewardship, husbandry, those are terms which are being used by many, many people, and some of them maybe do not know as much about agriculture as such as some of us in this room. And so I think it behooves all of us to kind of read what other people are saying and then make up our own minds as to where we're at. Now, what I pointed out before, my background is I've worked in agriculture all my life as an agronomist. I grew up on a farm, went to agricultural college, did advanced work in that. I worked at Iowa State University for many years, and I still consult in agricultural matters. So I feel like I've been pretty close to agriculture for a long time. And my specific area was working with alfalfa and forage crops and with grazing of livestock and silages and pasture and so on and so forth. So that tells you where I'm coming from. Now, what I'm leading up to is to say that if we go back in this history, we can pull up examples of what we might say are really bad husbandry, or bad stewardship, or inadequate stewardship. I don't think there's any question we can pull those up out of history. We can also pull up, if you wish, some excellent examples of good husbandry and good stewardship. And some of the things that they did way back when, not back in hunting and gathering, let's go back in the period of agriculture, some of the things that were done, you can say they didn't really know what they were doing. Science later proved that this was bad. When they first irrigated in the Tigris and Euphrates River Valley in biblical times, when they took those rivers and they built canals out to get water out to these people, they really didn't know that they were going to salinize those soils, that those soils, the salts in those soils, were going to come back up, and later then wheat would become marginal in production. In other words, it wouldn't grow, and then they had to grow barley. Wheat was the preferred crop because of the gluten in the wheat allows you to make bread from it, but barley doesn't make a very good bread. So they, But the lands became salinized, and they had to go to barley. And eventually, these lands went out of production. And the same thing happened, but at that time they didn't know. Now we know. Now where there's stewardship takes on a little bit different context today. And I think we can say, you know, if you're going to be irrigating this land and pumping up all this groundwater, science now knows what happens. And you ought to be monitoring that. And if you don't monitor it, should it be the role of the government to say, you can't do that anymore? You know, so stewardship, husbandry, these are all questions that are of interest. Yes?
Well, Chris? Over a year ago, I took a group of students from Malaysia down to Australia for a field trip. Mm-hmm. And we stayed at a little desert lodge out in sort of a natural preserve. And one of the trips we took, a day trip, was to a land reclamation project where they are trying to restore the farmlands that have become salinitized because of the overgrazing of the land by the sheep and the cattle. And they showed us some aerial photographs of these tremendously large farms where they were raising livestock and sheep. And what had happened, they'd cut all the trees down to make for the land, for the crops and so on. And all the salts were coming up, and it just totally destroyed everything, and they couldn't grow any pasture at all. Therefore, they were defeating their purpose. And so what they're doing now is that they are trying to rear on this land only the maximum that the land can support naturally. So before, if they had, let's say, 100 head of sheep, but the land says we can only feed 50 sheep, they're only putting 50 sheep on them. And they're replanting, and they're letting some of the hedgerows come back, and so on. But they've learned a very valuable lesson, because of all the salt that came up, and we couldn't believe it. You know, here we are in the middle of Australia, but here's the salt that's underlying the bedrock, and it just comes up when you take the natural groundwater off. And what was happening was that there was so much evaporation, you know, that the natural water was just being evaporated away.
That's right, and I'm glad you brought that up, because it's very interesting. Australia, from the standpoint of history, it really only been settled about 200 years plus, when Captain Cook first came there. At that time, the Aborigines in Australia were getting along quite well, thank you, before that, you see, because there were no introduced or domesticated crops whatsoever. So that's where they go back to study now what happened. In other words, you can't go back and study hunters and gatherers 200,000 years ago in other parts, but you can in Australia, because it does show the effect of... Okay, so then it was settled, and there's some classical blunders that they found out. That wasn't the only mistake they made. The one about rabbits is one of the... I wish I had one slide that I had should have had with me, because it's... You know, some Englishman down in Adelaide or someplace decided that he had this place. All he needed now were some English rabbits to make it just like jolly old England. So they brought the rabbits in there, and they just, boom, they just multiplied all over the place. And they just ate up everything. And the picture I have is an actual photograph, must be around 1900. It's a black and white onto a slide. And it just shows a watering hole that's about twice as big as this. And the rabbits are just in. There must be thousands of rabbits trying to get at the water. They've just denuded the countryside. So that was one ecological blunder. You know, and we can cite some of those cases in this country. Kudzu being introduced in the United States, got away down south. You know, in Russian thistle, you know, we've got some of these cases where crops and plants and animals have been introduced. So now the Australian thing is, after science came on, this was interesting that you saw that, because I was in Australia in 1970, and Australians can be very positive about what to do. And they had it all figured out how to take care of the grasslands, you know, for cattle. They said, well, it's very simple. Plant subterranean clover. I'll tell you about that in a minute. Subterranean clover and put on phosphate. That's it. You know, they had the answers. You go back down there now, and I was down there about 4 years ago again. They aren't so sure, because you see what happened after that. Those trees had been cut away, just exactly what you said. They upset the whole water cycle, and these salts began to move, and the evapotranspiration was something that was different than all those eons of time, and they've got another set of problems. It's exactly. So you could say, well, in the first instance, bringing the rabbits in, they didn't know that, I suppose, so, well, that's history. But the scientists, maybe going back just 15 years ago, they wouldn't have had to be quite so cocksure they had all the answers at that point in time. Yes?
Yeah, that brings up a good question about how much science really does know. Because what you're suggesting is that one might be able to forgive agricultural practices done in ignorance. But if we really know better, why do we make mistakes now?
Well, I'd like to end up, right, that's a good point. I'd like to end up, I'm going to go through some slides and come around that certainly mistakes will be made. Obviously, they'll continue to be made because even, you know, scientists aren't perfect by any means. But there are a lot of positive things that are being done. I mean, I think we have a set of situations going on where, like monitoring of groundwater and a lot of things that are very positive now. And you can kind of put the point, you can point the finger at what's causing the problem. You see, and that's exactly what is happening. It's not, we're not home free yet. Okay, now then, what I want to do, any other comments, questions? What I'd like to do is go with some slides, and we can be talking as we look at these. Because I'm going to show you like two cases of where some mistakes have been made, or changes. And you can almost say, well, what are we going to do about it? And that's kind of what I'd like to be sure that we all have a chance to speak up. So I guess the objective would be, and for conversation would be, is how do we go from what people would say, well, agriculture is represented maybe in the sort of an economy of exploitation, in some people's viewpoint. Other people would say, well, geez, we're just trying to make a living. You know, but if they say it's an economy of exploitation, we'd say, well, the timber industry has done the same thing and everybody else. But what we want to do is get over to the economy of conservation. And that's what I want to lead up to, is discuss alternative agriculture and what's going on. Any comments, questions, or should I go ahead and see what we got? Okay. All right. This is... And they don't show up so good in here unless somebody can dim them.
You want to hit the lights?
Yeah, why don't you hit those? That'll help some. It's not too important. Okay, there's
your own inverter.
Yeah. Well, they aren't. There's a couple over there that might help. The agriculture. Over time, I took these pictures down in Southern Iowa, and it shows a farm that's no longer economic. It's sort of out of the situation. Here we have a farmstead that was economical, no doubt. At one time, we see the pump here for water, and now we see some kind of a watering system with fences, so it's being grazed, and so forth. So agriculture has had a tough. Now let's talk about soil conservation and land use. This is perhaps one of the mistakes that a lot of corrections have been made, and it's going to take some time, but I think it's in a lot better shape than we were at one time. This is a shot in Iowa, shows just soil erosion off of a field that's plowed, didn't have a cover crop in the winter. In other words, there's wind erosion that just filled the road bank. But that's, Iowa farmers weren't the only ones that did this. I mean, in the French wine-growing country, the soil would come down to the bottom, and a classic picture is of people actually just scooping it into baskets and carrying it back up to the top of the hill and putting it up there and letting it come work down again so they could continue to grow wine or grapes. Okay, and this is a shot out north of Ames, Iowa, and this disturbed me a lot. This is called snert. It's a mixture of soil and or dirt and snow, and comes off some of those open fields. And the public doesn't like that. You can see it's come off of this field, and it's accentuated, maybe more than you think there is there, just by the way it looks. Or here's another one showing in, off, you know, coming off of a plowed field in the wintertime, and so forth. So this, now we have conservation tillage, and the leaves cover, out on these fields, and then this has been cut down a lot. So that's a lot of good has happened since. Here's another shot I took up in there in northeast Iowa, and the road banks and the snow had been blowing, and then they plowed the road, and you can see you've still got this mixed with the snow. So
when were these taken?
When? You mean year-wise? Or?
What year?
Oh, the they're all within the last 10, 15 years.
You can see it every winter.
Yeah. Where are you from?
I'm from western Wisconsin.
Okay.
Yeah.
North, south, east?
Well, I did live in Clear Lake, Iowa.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Lots of...
Yeah, but it is down now, I think. It's okay. Less because of the conservation tillage.
Right.
And in other words, leaving the mulch on top. Now, in Poland, I found out that they aren't doing that yet. And so this is a case of that we can transfer some of our, what we've learned as appropriate technology to the people of Poland. They've been cultivating those soils for, you know, long time. And they just overworked them. They've just overworked their soils. So there's a lot of... Okay, then these are a set of recent pictures. This is western Iowa, and I worked, part of my research was at experiment farm, western Iowa, so I was out there many times a year. And this is the type of land you have. These are, see cattle grazing on these hills. This is windblown silt, or LOESS, L-O-E-S-S, soil. In other words, it's blown off the Missouri River bottom and deposited in rolling hills of western Iowa. And these, the topsoil and the subsoil, it isn't very distinct. This is pretty much silt top to bottom. And they used to cut these, road has been redone, but they used to cut these road banks straight up and down. And they just, you just drive through a little narrow. And then now they've done it this way, and then they'll seed those down. So the road has been redone. And here it shows cropping in those hills, what can result. You can see that the soils are being lighter. They've lost some of this, even the topsoil. You can see it all on this one, where the top, the really high organic matter soil on the top has come down. So there is soil erosion going on. And whether this will be a mistake or not, I don't know, but the Soil Conservation Service has talked about what we need to do in that country is put in bench terraces, what they call bench terraces. In other words, you would level this land out, and you'd drop it down, level it out again, so that you could put in as many as 16 rows of corn in there. And then you can get in there with, you can go through there with an 8-row corn planter and come back the other way with another 8 rows.
Well, we drove through that area 2 years ago, and we saw a lot of people doing that.
Yeah.
This year we drove through there, and it looked like they were reverting back to
you. Is that right?
We were a little bit further north.
So even within a government agency like the Soil Conservation Service, you could say, where are they getting their messages from? What is driving the rules and the regulations that they do? For example, they say that you can have 5 ton of per acre of soil loss, which is acceptable. And other people would say it's too high. If you calculate out with 5 ton of good topsoil year after year, I mean, you know, your grandchildren and your great-great-grandchildren, I mean, they're just going to have less soil farm on it, period.
And what drives that, if we do know better, this is my question again, and the experience I've had is that the farmers really do have a yearly bottom line.
Yes.
And that drives most of the decisions.
Yes.
That they aren't able, in the way the economy runs, to say, well, let's take a 20-year conservation plan and implement it, and the heck with the bottom line this year, you know what I mean? They tend to have to make their money year by year.
Yes, I agree. It's great. But there are some programs that are, and I'll mention one after a while, that allow for a little bit further planning. Now I want to show you. The next 4 slides are a little, on the way to that farm, there's a sort of a dip. The road goes down through here, and there's a little spot out here. It can't be over 7 or 8 acres. And I started taking pictures of that place because it bothered me. And this guy growing corn. You see the corn rows are just coming up here now.
But he wanted to plant corn in this area, and yet he gets a lot of erosion. You know, there's left old grass waterway, but I mean, basically, it ought not to be in corn. But it kept, in spite of all the assistance, in spite of all the ag college, you know, great Iowa State mm-hmm. University, telling them, you know, it shouldn't do that. It's bad land use. Still happens. And this one is some years later, still doing it, you know? He just wants to grow corn. He leaves a little area here, apparently, and but then basically he's put his corn here. See, he's got a, I don't know how many rows we got there, but he's using pretty modern equipment to get that little field in the corn. And now when it tasseling time, you drive by there and say, you know, that's a pretty nice field of corn, but you don't see it. And then again, here's another year. I think one year he did pull it out and seeded down some alfalfa or something, but you see it's not, the soil is very variable. So I guess my point on that is that that in spite of all that he knew better, he or she or whoever ran the place, the steward of that piece of land, in spite of the fact that they knew it, it still happens. And they're going by the bottom line, they're going by their... And at the same time, somebody else is doing a really, really good job of stewardship and husbandry. So,
well,
yes?
What would you tell that farmer to do with that piece of land?
Take it out. That's so small. And seed it down into a legume, pasture it. But you see, he may have gone to corn farming, and he maybe doesn't have any cattle. And he'd say, well, by the time I fence this area, 8 acres, and try to pasture it, forget it.
Well, that might be a major portion, percentage of his holdings, though.
That's right.
He may be a marginal farmer. Yeah.
Yep. But, there's maybe enough blame to go around. In other words, you could say, is it the government program that does it? Is it the farmer himself? Is it the bottom line? Is it the banker that wants notes paid? Is it, what is it that does it? But that's an example of that. And even some of the professors that I used to work with, they'd say, a professor of ag engineering that thought that he was pretty forward. In fact, soils, and I used to say that because I'd come out of Wisconsin where if you lose your topsoil, northern Wisconsin, you know, you've had it. And these Lush Hills, this fellow said, well, just think of it over a long span of time. Let nature even out these hills.
Whoa.
You see what I mean? In other words, after a while, maybe those Lush Hills will be all more even if you let erosion take place. In the meantime, of course, there are those people that live in those towns going down there. The rivers come down. They say, I don't like this muddy river. I don't like this silt coming down here. And they are beginning to speak, and the laws are not going to allow that. Oh, I know what he could do with that now, by the way. And this is prior to, he's maybe put that in the Conservation Reserve Program, because that's highly erodible land, and he maybe got a contract on that for 10 years to take it out. And he had a corn base on this. He had a corn base on this, so he's getting paid now for the mistakes he made before. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
And the thing is, and I hate to tell you, I can get kind of mean on this because you've heard of double dipping. You know, they say that, okay, I would say some of these people are almost triple dipping because they did it wrong in the first place. They shouldn't have been doing it. So then they got paid for taking it out of production. And the triple dipping will come in unless the Conservation Reserve Program says you cannot put that back in to corn. He'll come right back. And if he seeded that alfalfa for 10 years and let it sit, he can come back in 10 years and he can grow corn in that like mad because it's fixed a lot of nitrogen over 10 years.
I have a friend who on a 200 acre farm that had maybe a 60 acre corn base. He stopped plowing. He grows grass. And I think, don't you lose your corn base if you take it out of production? And he doesn't get
it. It's based on the previous 5 years. Does somebody know that?
Well, he's been there 5 years now, so that no corn grown. What he does is rotate pastures for sheep and cows. He's never going to plow it.
Well,
I think he's taken a double hit that way, you know, because he doesn't have the opportunity for corn based subsidy.
But
he also. Doesn't produce high Well, I guess the advantage he has is that he doesn't need a tractor.
That's right.
And he's gone to a low input farming that's actually building topsoil and keeping the use of energy on the farm
right.
to a real minimum. And he's doing okay.
Is he getting paid to have it fallow?
No.
Yeah.
No, it's not fallow. He's grazing yeah. and making hay.
The Conservation Reserve Program, you aren't supposed to graze or harvest off it unless there was a drought. Well, that's be a form of conservation tillage, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's very sensible.
Well, they have troubles with it.
The thing about conservation tillage when you leave a lot of refuse on the field to prevent wind erosion in the winter, and then you go in and plant corn, they tell me, and I'm sure it's true, that you might even have to use a little more herbicide for weed control than less.
Mm-hmm. A lot more.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Like what order?
Oh, probably a third more.
Is that right?
Sure. Can't cultivate it, and so if you don't control those weeds, you don't get anything.
Yeah. So
you got to give it enough so you make sure you got the weeds, or else you go back over and give it another shot.
Okay, so you see, that's a disadvantage.
I mean, there's, you know, there's a two-edged sword.
Yeah.
With this conservation.
Yeah.
My friend here who raises grass, he's had to make some compromises with controlling weeds at his fence. He just had too many fences to go out there and hand cut it down, so he goes out and spots it with Roundup.
And
sprays his fence.
Well, these are really interesting. In relation to the point of the all grass, when I was discussing last week, one of the volunteers in the village, a young woman, asked me if I had ever heard of this book called Gaining Ground, The Renewal of America's Small Farm. I said, no, I hadn't. And I'd heard of the book called Losing Ground, which had to do with soil erosion. And so she gave it to me, and she's here for a longer time, and I've read it. But there's an interesting story in here about a farmer in northeast Iowa, and I don't think I'd ever heard of him before. He'd been farming, quote, organically for 20, 25 years, but he has very modern techniques going. In fact, this farmer has four harvester silos, and a lot of people, you know, right away, they come driving down the road, and if they see harvester silos, they say, well, this is some farmer that's a Cadillac farmer, you know, and it's not typical. But this farmer follows from what you said, is growing just mostly grass, alfalfa, and beef cattle. It buys them in, grazes hay, and so forth. And it's proven, it's shown in here that it's doing fairly well, thank you, and has virtually cut down herbicide use and pesticide use down to just about anything, and simplified his machinery operation and a whole bunch of things. So that's really quite striking that they've happened to pick a first illustration here in that book. I've got some other ones I want to point out to you after a bit. So anyhow, there's a case. Now, let's take another one. This is, I just saw this myself. I'm an adjunct professor at the University of Minnesota, and first put these slides together, and I asked them if I could borrow them. A series of six slides. And they're talking about the dairy enterprise and the use of forages and, of course, the production of milk. In other words, this has changed a lot. And so he had some beautiful slides, and he let me borrow them. If you go from 1900 to the year 2000, and the milk produced, this is what's happened. In other words, it's just gone up. Total amount of milk produced in the U.S. So that's that. Okay, the number of the cows that you have in the United States is going up for a while, to about 1940, and has gone down, okay? And that is because the average milk production per cow has gone up. So you got less cows to produce more milk, okay? And so here you go.
Wow.
The milk production per lactation, in other words, during 1 year for the cow, this is constantly going up. And the target that the top producers are shooting for is constantly going higher. And so it's sort of driven that way. Yes?
So it means that one cow per year is giving over 16,000 pounds of milk?
Yes.
And some of it, that's
not too good a cow.
No, that's right.
That's just
not a great cow. No, you've got to get up 25,000 pounds. then you're getting up to good.
Yeah, see,
some herds will have that as a average for the whole herd, 20,000 pounds.
Yeah, see,
for a herd.
Are you a dairy farmer?
No, but I'm from Greene County. And that's
in Wisconsin.
That's the cheese capital of the world.
So he's exactly right. This target is moving higher and higher. Oh, wow. See what I mean? And so some of us say, my God, you know, aren't there some systems by which we could say, we'll accept 15,000. We got along back here. Now, this is where I was a kid on a farm in northern Wisconsin back in these years, and I went off in service, and then I was in college, and then I've been working as an agronomist. But back then, I'm pretty sure our average milk production per year wasn't even that high on the farm I grew up in.
And how much does an average cow weigh?
1,200 pounds, did I catch it?
Oh, Holstein's, the cow that'll produce that much would be bigger than that. She'll be 1,500 pounds.
So an average cow is doing more than 10 times its weight in milk per year.
That's right.
Well, and for the farmer, the decision is, well, do you want to milk 4 cows and get that much milk, or do you want to milk one?
And then, there are all kinds of arguments. They're very interesting. Quite a scientist in New Zealand some years ago had, by the name of McMeekin, and I used to teach this in class, because he believed that you could take Jersey cows, which are, what, 800 or 900?
Yeah.
Okay, so in other words, you're talking, rather than having a 1,200-pound cow, you got an 800-pound cow. And then you take the proportion that goes to the cow for maintenance and for production. That's a split. In other words, to just maintain an 800-pound person or an animal requires a certain amount of energy.
Right.
So on the other one, you're maintaining 1,200, and then you're getting the production. Right. So what he did was he said that he could go out there and he could stock more cattle of the 800 pounders on a certain piece of land. And what I used to, than he could of 1,200 pounders.
But how much milk was he getting from those?
He got less. But totally speaking, off his land, he got more. So it was milk per acre rather than milk per cow.
Well, the New Zealanders are still, we were down there last year, and they're still working under that principle. Their
That's
Holstein
right.
cows are probably 200 to 300 pounds lighter than ours, and they run them on almost a total grass management.
That's right.
And they don't get near the production out of them, but the bottom line they think is better
That's
than
right.
ours, because they don't pour the grain into them, and they don't force the cows. They don't have to have quite a turnover. These cows, you have a pretty big turnover. You get 20,000 pound cows, you're really forcing them.
And I had a question last
you're
week.
You replace them a lot.
I had a question on that last week. What was the longevity of a cow in the herd, the 20,000 pound herd, or the
versus the 20, five?
Is it the 4, 5, 6 lactations? Or
yeah, I'd say it'd be.
Yeah, whereas they used to count on 10, 11, 12, I think, in the olden days.
So in terms of actual cost-benefit analysis, you have to factor that in.
Oh, yes. And then what I used to do for the class, when I taught this at Iowa State, present this, I gave them there's a takeout. I told them about New Zealand, I told them about here, and I said, now, okay, does it work over here? And what, of course, they've got to get into land costs and taxation and the price of cow, and, you know, if you're going to calculate milk per acre or milk per cow, and so it's complex. But anyhow, going on the dairy industry, so if you chart this is the same type of a deal from USDA. Milk cow coming, the production per cow going up, milk production staying the same or going up. So in other words, it's, and in fact, milk production, okay, so what you end up, you know, this is a shot in the milking parlor. It's very highly, it's very technically oriented. The milker that stands there can put on the milker and the teacups. He knows exactly how many times he can punch the buttons and whatever he needs to do, and the milk flows into the pipeline and away it goes. So, you know, you're going to literally have a milk factory. And so that's going to drive it this way. And I leave that with you, saying, okay, that's the dairy industry. And what, you know, how's that going to change? How can it change? I don't have the answer. And I don't like it just going on up, becoming more and more of a milk factory.
Well, we're talking about a growth hormone that will increase
yes.
production 40% per cow.
Oh, yeah, I know. Did you hear 40%?
Oh, it's not that much.
Well,
no.
That's what Monsanto was saying once.
Yeah, they have a, I don't know if you heard about this, but it's a bovine growth hormone, or the and the states of Minnesota and Wisconsin are really arguing this about in the legislature whether it should be allowed. But it's a, the cow would get an injection each day of a certain hormone, and it would, what I'd heard was 20%, and they've even backed off of that now. So in other words, it's another technology which would be sort of necessary to keep up with the industry.
How would that impact on the number of lactations or the useful
productive
life of the cow as far as...
Do you know?
I don't... The research so far says it doesn't hurt the cow. It's a natural hormone. The cow produces it anyhow. It's in her body. And they just synthesize this and give her more of it.
That's
so
right.
She produces more milk. And they're suppressing technology. And when you start suppressing technology that we've developed, when you think all the where we've gotten now, and you start saying laws, hey, you can't use that, you're going to impact agriculture that hasn't been impacted in the last 40 years. Because we're using growth hormones and beef cattle, and if they'd passed laws like this 20 years ago, it would have really made a difference in our beef business.
Right.
Those who argue against it say, we haven't really taken into account the effect on animals, you know. And there are consumers who say they just don't.
Yeah, and the small farmers say we already got too much milk. Why, you know, milk is too cheap now. Why produce more?
Stockpile of milk and cheese and stuff 2 or 3 years. That's what I heard.
And what about these diets, heart diets, and other kind of diets that are sort of down on dairy products altogether? Is something which is bad for your arteries and all that stuff.
Yeah, and the dairy farmer who really can't really switch with the times if 1 year dairy products are out of favor.
You're married to a dairy business. Yeah. That's a long-term commitment. You don't just jump in and out of.
And it's, I think it's real difficult for farmers who have always thought they were feeding the world.
Right.
And then just in the last 10 years, there are rumblings that they are the ones who are destroying the planet. and it's going down hard with those who have really taken a hit, because to get into farming these days, you have to invest $250,000 and depend on a $10,000 a year income.
Wow.
Yeah. And there aren't anybody that would invest in that sort of thing.
What about the move from small farms to larger consolidated corporate farming, this kind of broken heartland syndrome that David's referring to? Is that a real thing, or is that just a...
Well, the number of farmers going out of business has just been constant since the 20s and 30s.
It's real in Illinois. I mean, they're talking 1,000-acre lands in the heart of Illinois.
Uh-huh. And, it used to be, what, 300?
160. Or, 640 would be a large
farm. This is sort of the contention in this book on gaining ground, and if you read it, that it's already, some of this has already happened. In other words, you had large corporations, large whatever, have aggregated units of farming. And that's a far cry from what originally was perceived as the heart of American agriculture, the family farm.
But they're still family farms, but they're just bigger.
That's right.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, like that picture you showed of that abandoned farm, you drive through Iowa or southern Illinois or northern Illinois or southern Wisconsin, and you'll go by and there'll be one farm that will be run down, and the next farm was lived in.
That's right.
And he works that other farm. And now it's gotten to be three farms. It was two. Now it's three. And it's getting bigger. In my area, there are little dairy farms. Some of them are still 80, 120 acres. But when this generation is gone, somebody else isn't going to come in there and work that 120 acres. It's going to join to the next 120 acres.
So
I've seen it in my lifetime. It's just moving bigger. They used to advance that bigger is better, but it's just the economics that's driving it now. But
would you call that a... So when will we drop the term family farm?
Oh, we won't. There'll be 2-3 children in it, or a man and 2-3 hired men, but it'll still be considered a family farm.
That's incorporated and huge, rather than a small farm.
What is the demographics, though? I mean, are there children that are just saying, I don't want to do this farm?
Right. They're just moving out. I tell you, we're losing our young people in our neighborhood.
That is a big question.
That's our biggest loss.
And the other side of that is that there's nobody that even has a chance to farm except the child of a farmer.
You have to be born into it.
Well, you have to have a parent who loves you that's going to give you the
Well, there's exceptions to that, but it's there's so much money involved. You gotta really, it's like being a preacher. You gotta wanna farm, and you take a night job and rent a little land and you sacrifice but everything in that farm, and maybe by the time you're 35 you can farm full time. But it's a real sacrifice to if you're gonna do it in the big families, big farm style. You can still work 80 acres and maybe work uptown part time.
See, I think it's misconceiving because you get the city boy that goes out to visit a distant relative over the summer holiday and goes out to the farm and says, wow, you've got thousands and thousands of acres and you've got all of these big tillers and all these John Deere tractors and the harvesters and these silos. You must be filthy rich. And yet the guys are just barely being able to buy their daily bread.
Yeah. Right.
I'm going to ask you before you change that.
Okay.
What is the average lactation period for a cow before she dries up? Second part of the question is then, when do they breed her again? So how long is she out of service before she starts producing?
The lactation period was 180? No. 280.
It's a normal year.
Yeah. In other words,
it's a normal year. I mean, they have a calf.
Once a year.
It takes
right.
9 months
gestation.
Gestation period. And they usually breed back in a couple months.
And they,
3 months. So it's just about an annual.
They're dry months.
And they dry up. They like to have them dry for a month at least.
Yeah.
Sometimes two.
So they're in production for a year and they're out of production for about 11 months.
No. They have a calf milk for say 9 months or 10 months, and they might be dry for 1 month to 2 months.
Right.
Then they'll have a calf, and then they'll freshen, and then they'll milk again. So it's just about an annual.
One other question on the dairy. What allowed the curve of milk production per cow to change? Before 1950, it was very shallow, and then after 1950, it took off.
Artificial insemination and
breeding.
Breeding
and feeding a lot more grain.
Okay.
And getting the nutrition shaped up. But the breeding was a fantastic influence there. Okay, so let's. So we could say, we could say we're all in this mess together, right? We could say that, right?
Yeah, we're wallowing in it.
I took that picture in Iowa one day. I saw those pigs out there, and I thought, we could say that. Or we could be as optimistic as this old fellow going to a picnic. He's bringing the anteater along to eat up the ants, and be prepared and move ahead. So I guess there are various ways of looking at it. Now, what comes in here, and this the same person that a few weeks ago was talking about the dairy industry, and when we're considering crops and livestock both, and we know that a lot of the land that where the soil erosion should be planted to these more soil-conserving crops. So one of the things that's being looked at right now is taking something like alfalfa or lucerne that was used by the Romans, and it's a fantastic crop. There aren't many negatives about alfalfa, as you can think of. What are some other possibilities for use of alfalfa? Well, in human foodstuffs, of course, we know it, and that would not, you wouldn't need to plant a lot of acreage to take care of that. But protein supplements, and there's been a lot of work done with extracting from the alfalfa leaves the proteins that are needed. Biologicals, pharmaceuticals, industrial enzymes, industrial commodities, chemical feedstuffs, biomass, energy resource, and paper pulp. These are interesting. And he had some slides on that. So there are other places, there are possibilities to grow alfalfa in other words, it's not just being used for alfalfa sprouts or for feeding to dairy. So that we can, and here's some work that's being done is different types of alfalfa that fix more nitrogen. In other words, the nodules on the root are actually fixing considerably more nitrogen than what's been historically. Normally, an alfalfa crop, 1 year of alfalfa will fix about 125 pounds of nitrogen per acre in the soil, and that's just about enough to grow a corn crop. So if you followed alfalfa with corn, you can kind of get along. But what's been said is that I'll just grow corn continuously and buy the nitrogen, 125 pounds a year, 150 pounds, and away you go. And of course, if he gets too much nitrogen on there, a certain soil is going to end up in the water, in the groundwater. So this is a, if you take one of these alfalfa and you chart this out, as this scientist did at U of M, the total amount of nitrogen fixed by alfalfa, and he just calculated it up on a big basis so he could budget it out. And you harvest off his forage a portion of the total amount, and that's fed to livestock. That some of that nitrogen ends up in the milk, which when it ends up and it can be assimilated into protein by the human body. Some of it would go into meat. The nitrogen in the manure, which is quite a substantial amount of this, ends up here. Now that's one of the problems. It can be a problem because some of this will be from gaseous sources will be lost into the atmosphere, or you could take some of this could be returned to the soil, so you could have a cycle that would in this. This is not a biological cycle for nitrogen, but it's a cycle that would show how the symbiotically fixed nitrogen from alfalfa in the Corn Belt states could be looked at. That would be environmentally friendly, so to speak. But there are a lot of things that need to be you have to have an understanding that this is the way it's going to be.
Well, excuse me, yep. How much more nitrogen per acre were these experimental crops, were they hoping these experimental crops would give them?
Well, they're only getting in the order now about, 30. It's in the order of 5 or 10% increases.
Okay.
But as the breeding work progresses, it should be able to get better. But what happens is, I don't know if you noticed the sign on that, it said non-dormant, which meant that they were more annual. In other words, they had to be planted each year rather than those that are planted perennially.
Right.
But that, you see, that's in this alternative agriculture. That's one of the things they're looking for, is that how could you plug back in a year of alfalfa into the system? Because I used to argue with other profs at Iowa State, and they would right away, I'd say, put alfalfa in there, and right away they'd calculate out the balance sheet, and they'd say, I can't afford to put it in there. Can't afford to put it in for a year. I've got to keep that year. I've got to keep corn in there. See? Okay, and here's another one. Then this in the alternative agriculture is some other ways. This is experimentally being done, where you would alternate the production of the corn one year with the row that's in the alfalfa the other year. And they did it on small, quite sizable plots. But a farmer could actually be. And here it's oriented. Here you have it oriented to take greatest advantage.
So you switch rows then every other year?
Or areas, right.
Oh.
It's sort of a new concept. It's not called crop rotation, but sort of a strip farming alternate crop situation. Some of these involve grains that you'd get three crops in two years type of situation. So there are many agronomic things that can be done. And the other one, of course, that can be done is take this hillier land, like I showed you before in the western part of the state, where this land was terraced, and the farmer received payment from the Soil Conservation Service to terrace this land. These are the small terraces. And then he was planting corn in between these terraces. And that became non-economic, so put that back into a legume and pasture it. And then, of course, here's some of the work that needs to be done experimentally on that is to figure out the competition that you get between something like an orchard grass and a crown vetch, which is a legume. These two. What is the, are you getting enough nitrogen to get a productive crop out of it? And you end up with something that gives you the impression of, more stability. In other words, everything looks in place there. You know, you don't see erosion in this rolling hilly land. This land would have all been cropped before, but now it's in pasture. You see the effects of earlier erosion coming down there. You can see here where there's travel even with livestock, you get some erosion here. And the stream flow is down, or the... now what I'd like to do, see, what do we got? We've got 10 minutes.
How do you work the animal rights and the animal welfare people in with your alfalfa? I mean, yeah, if it's good for the earth, not to plow the ground, what you're eating up eating meat. And what you say is that there are people who say that eating vegetables, being a vegetarian, is good biologically. But this argues that it's terrible agriculturally, that to plow and plant.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah, so I'm a meat eater myself, and my source of meat is grass-fed beef, and that's really low on the food chain. There's the grass, there's the cow, and then there's meat.
What I wanted to do, and that'd be a good time to present it to you, if we have time.
Would one of you want to flip that light over there? We'll just let the projector on. If we have time, I'm going to show you a few more. But if you take what we call organic farming or gardening, and put it on one end of the spectrum here, and then on the other end you put the scientific agriculture, chemical farming, or whatever you might want to call it. The people will, depends upon how much at odds these people are. They'll be shooting arrows at each other, you know. We can put the word chemicals over there, that doesn't bother me, but let's say you can put American agriculture. This is what I gave you some illustrations over here. Okay? Now, they just didn't talk to each other before. I mean, they were just shooting arrows at each other about that. These people on this end would say, you know, you're all wrong. This, you've got to do it this way. People over here in the land grant university say, no, this, when you tell them, we know how a phosphorus enters the plant. We know how potassium enters the plant, and it doesn't make a particle of difference whether it comes out of a bit of organic matter or it doesn't. It can come out of rock phosphate just as well as coming out of an organic system. And so there's been standoff, but now they're coming together. And you don't hear this word as much anymore. I think that's a compromise that's been made over on that end. You just don't hear that as much anymore. And you maybe don't hear as much over here. And what you do hear is alternative agriculture. And words are important, you know, as to what they convey to people. And it seems to be agreement on alternative agriculture. But in the meantime, before they got there, they had to go through a bunch of other terms. And some of them aren't bad, but one of the ones that was been sort of discarded now is called low input agriculture. And there was even a government program that had the acronym LISA, that there were funds that you could, LISA was low input sustainable agriculture, and they've discarded that term. Because right away some of these people said, hey, we are talking that. We've been talking for years at the agricultural colleges. You think that all we do is get up and sell pesticides and herbicides and insecticides in our classes. That's not true. We teach good management. We talk best management practices. We try to teach about soil conservation. We do all these things that are good. We teach courses in animal husbandry, and we don't call it animal stewardship, but we call it animal husbandry. So we've been doing a lot of these things that are good. And so we don't like this idea of low input, because that implies that, you know, you don't need as much intelligence to farm that way. You've got to have just as much intelligence and sensibility to farm alternatively as you maybe do over here. So let's discard that term. So you don't see that so much anymore. So they changed that LISA. They changed LISA, and they call it SAR now. And that's the sustainable agriculture, sustainable ag, and research education. Okay, so there. Now there's money available. So you can make proposals and get money to work.
That's federal money?
Yes, through the Department of Agriculture. So the it's beginning to move. It's beginning to move. But if you take the total amount of money that's going in this area versus maybe what these people perceive was going in over here, it's not great, but it's moving that direction. And one of the things, and I'm going to leave these for the Holden Library when I go, because I can get additional copies, but this would be a little contribution to Holden.